I'm Dean Reuter, and it's my pleasure and my privilege to welcome our next speaker, a man who really is known to all of us, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. But you, please. I should probably stop right there, but let me continue on. What you might not know about Senator Cruz is just what an impressive life and career he had even before he was elected to the United States Senate. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. He is a Princeton and Harvard Law School grad with honors. At the Harvard Law School, he was, of course, involved in the Federalist Society student chapter. There's no surprise there. In fact, I think had there been no Harvard chapter, he probably would have created one. After law school, he served first in the judicial branch, where he clerked for Michael Luttig on the Fourth Circuit. Next, he became the first Hispanic to clerk for a U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice, clerking for Chief Justice Rehnquist. Deftly switching branches, he served as an Associate Deputy Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice, and then as a domestic policy advisor to President George W. Bush on the Bush-Cheney campaign, and then a Director of the Policy and Planning at the Federal Trade Commission. Moving into state government now, in 2003, he was appointed as the youngest and first Hispanic Solicitor General of Texas and went on to become that state's longest-serving Solicitor General. In private practice, Senator Cruz spent 5 years leading his firm's appellate and Supreme Court practice, amassing a stellar record before the High Court, including many landmark victories. Now, in the legislative branch, Senator Cruz serves on the Judiciary Committee and committees on Armed Services, Commerce, Science, and Transportation, the Joint Economic Committee, and the Rules Committee. Now, by my math, adding up all that experience, I calculate you're approaching your 80th birthday. Truly impressive resume. Senator Cruz, most importantly, has been an incredibly engaged and influential lawyer in every branch of government and state government as well. Throughout it all, he has stood firmly for limited constitutional government, individual liberty, and the rule of law. The Federal Society is once again very pleased to welcome a longtime friend, Senator Ted Cruz.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dean, for highlighting my persistent inability to hold a job. Although in many manifestations, I have always been able to say, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. It is wonderful to be back at the Federalist Society Lawyers Convention. Like many of you, I've been to this convention many, many times. Indeed, this is one of the first years in a while that Thursday night, I wasn't up on the second floor playing poker at 2 a.m, as many of us have done. And this gathering of friends, of passionate leaders, is an extraordinary gathering. As I was observing to Dean and Leonard and Jean a few moments ago, the timing of this convention is always interesting. The timing of this convention, we could have been here in mourning and sackcloth and ashes, wondering what might become of the Republic. Or we could have been here in celebration, many with resumes in your pockets. Or, as Dean recalled, in the year 2000, nobody could have been here because everyone could have been in Florida in the middle of the recount. But it's always interesting, and now is certainly interesting as well. We stand on the cusp of great change. An astounding election occurred just over a week ago. An election that was a mandate for change. An election in which the voters entrusted Republicans with control of the White House, control of every federal agency, and control of both the Senate and the House. That is rare. That does not come along often. And it provides both an incredible opportunity for real and meaningful change, but also responsibility. A responsibility, I believe, that we've got to deliver. We've got to actually deliver the change, the fidelity to the Constitution, the defense of liberty that was promised to the voters. And I will say, I stand here filled with great hope that we're going to do exactly that. I'm particularly pleased to offer words of congratulations to my colleague and good friend, Jeff Sessions, who is going to make an extraordinary Attorney General of the United States. He is a committed and deeply principled conservative. And if those who serve in this administration have even a fraction of his integrity and his commitment to principle, we are going to see an administration that does remarkable things for the people of this country. This gathering is also a celebration and remembrance of our friend, Justice Antonin Scalia. Many of us knew Justice Scalia personally. He was one of a kind. And his legacy will endure forever. You know, one of my favorite stories about Justice Scalia was back when he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit. And at the time, he and Robert Bork were the two leading judges, conservative judges on the D.C. Circuit. Reagan was in the White House. And everyone knew that one or the other was likely to get the next seat on the Supreme Court. And Justice Scalia was walking through the parking garage at the court, and two U.S. Marshals stopped him at the elevator. They said, "I'm sorry, sir, we're holding this elevator for the Attorney General of the United States." Scalia pushed past them, stepped into the elevator, jammed the button, and as the door was closing, he said, "You tell Ed Meese Bob Bork doesn't wait for anyone!" That's a true story. And the rest, as they say, was history. You know, shortly after Justice Scalia's passing, members of the Senate were invited to submit into the congressional record statements commemorating Justice Scalia's remarkable career. Now, I'm sure that the Federalist Society crowd here can see the irony in a request to supplement the congressional record, of all things, with praise for Justice Scalia. Given his sterling sense of humor, I suspect Justice Scalia would rather have enjoyed learning of that request. After all, we're talking about a man who waged a 30-year war against legislative history. And the idea that the congressional record was something more than the public musings of self-important legislators who like to hear themselves talk, well, he would have been amused by that, and I must say I'm very glad personally that's not a failing I suffer from. I can almost see Justice Scalia leaning back, grinning ear to ear, saying, "That is some request. How about if they really cared, they just stop passing unconstitutional laws?" Irony aside, I was pleased to comply with the request, and I'll share a little bit of what I submitted into the record. Antonin Scalia was one of the greatest Supreme Court justices in the history of our country, a lion of the law. Justice Scalia spent his tenure on the bench championing federalism, the separation of powers, and our fundamental liberties. He was a passionate defender of the Constitution. Not the Constitution as it has been contorted and revised by generations of activist jurists, but the Constitution as it was understood by the people who ratified it and made it the law of the land. Scalia understood that if the Constitution's meaning was not grounded in its text, history, and structure, but could instead be revised by judicial fiat, then the people were no longer sovereign. No longer would the nation be governed by law which expresses the will of the people. It would be governed by, as Scalia put it, an unelected committee of nine. This, he wrote, robs the people of the most important liberty they asserted in the Declaration of Independence and won in the Revolution of 1776, the freedom to govern themselves. The loss of Justice Scalia helped shape the recent presidential election as a referendum on his ideas. Would Americans choose to be ruled by the Constitution as written, or would they be ruled instead by unelected activist judges with life tenure? That was the question put to the American people. And I would note, it's not a question we the people would have been able to answer if the Senate had confirmed President Obama's replacement for Justice Scalia. The Senate, Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley, together stood up and rightly said, in exercising our constitutional advice and consent, our advice is the people will determine who replaces this seat. That's how our democratic republic is supposed to work. And the referendum that the voters expressed on Election Day was stunning. The stakes, had Hillary Clinton been elected and had she nominated an activist judge to replace Justice Scalia, we would have seen the very contours of the Constitution and Bill of Rights altered for generations. They would surely have rolled back basic protections on free speech in the First Amendment, including, as she had promised, overturning the Citizens United decision. A case, I might note, where the government was seeking to ban a movie critical of Hillary Clinton. I cannot imagine anyone wanting to be critical of Hillary Clinton. They would also have certainly narrowly interpreted religious liberty, stripping away the right to free exercise, to follow your faith, and instead giving government the power to force you to choose between abandoning your faith and principles or facing the coercive power of the government. They would have reversed the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, the individual right upheld in Heller, Justice Scalia's most consequential decision. They would have likely banned the death penalty and struck down the federal ban on partial birth abortion. All of that was on the ballot just over a week ago. Instead, and in contrast, President-elect Trump assured the American people that if elected, he would nominate constitutionalists in the mold of Justice Scalia. So in a very real respect, Justice Scalia was on the ballot as well. And thanks to the historic victory we saw last week, it gives me immense pleasure to say the people have spoken, and Justice Scalia has won as well. And that's fitting, because Justice Scalia never lost faith in the American people, never lost faith in the goodness and the ability of Americans to govern ourselves. We now have an historic opportunity to return to the Constitution, an historic opportunity to restore integrity to the federal government. One of the most shameful aspects of the last 8 years was the Obama administration's unprecedented assault on the rule of law, a repeated willingness to defy the law over and over and over again. Obamacare, changed unilaterally over and over and over again by an executive branch unworried about actually complying with statutes and the text of the United States Code. Immigration laws, welfare reform, an administration that would routinely ignore or attempt to unilaterally change the law. And then, of course, there was the abuse of power of the IRS targeting individual citizens for exercising free speech rights in a way inconsistent with the political desires of the administration. We mustn't forget that the law is a very real manifestation of the voice of the people. If we ignore the law, we ignore the people. If we change the law without authority, we supplant the voice of the people. And if we abuse the law, we abuse the people. The people are sovereign only so long as law is sovereign. As no man or woman is above the law, but rather we are all one nation, governed by rule of law. And because of the election, we here in this room have an enormous opportunity to help revive and restore our nation. If you look around at this gathering may well be the single largest collection of individuals who are likely to serve in the new administration. If you look down the aisles at your friends and neighbors and colleagues, I have great confidence that we are collectively looking at scores of federal judges, that we are looking at many men and women in this room who will choose to go to work in the Department of Justice, working to restore the integrity to that department, which it has had under both Republicans and Democrats for centuries, an integrity that has been badly shaken. We have men and women who may be serving in every federal agency, independent agencies, going to serve our nation. That's a remarkable opportunity. It's a remarkable responsibility. And that also means that in doing so, for those who choose to serve, who have the opportunity to serve, we could not do better than to follow the example that was blazed by Justice Scalia. It's important to remember that before he was our beloved justice, indeed, well before he was even a judge, he was general counsel of the Office of Telecommunications Policy. He was chairman of the Administrative Conference of the United States, and he was assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. It was in positions like these where he met Leviathan face to face, all while honing his skills for fights to come. And for each of us, I look forward to continuing to working hard in the Senate, to fight for the principles this country was founded on, and for many in this room, it will be our opportunity once again to do our part and serve, for some anew, for others yet another time serving our nation. And I would note, the mission of public service, particularly in these times, is not for the faint-hearted. The federal government can be overwhelming, almost too massive to comprehend. The challenges are daunting. The established interests are entrenched. As they say in politics, it ain't beanbag. But we need all hands on deck. And I am so grateful for an institution like the Federalist Society, an institution that is devoted to ideas. This is not a partisan organization. This is instead a gathering of individuals who cherish and value freedom and the Constitution. Those ideas and a fidelity to them desperately need to be returned to the federal government. And before I close, I'd like to share a few guiding principles for those of you thinking about taking the opportunity to serve. First and very simply, be honest and trustworthy. If we are to be good stewards of the law, we must be good stewards of our souls. Do not follow the example of the previous administration. The practice of law is, or at least should be, a deeply moral undertaking. To faithfully interpret and apply the law, especially as servants of the people, requires the utmost integrity. The people, after all, have every right to expect that government officials reach their legal conclusions in good faith. If a citizenry is to believe that the law is being subverted for political or any other illegitimate ends, they will lose faith in the government, in the rule of law, in the idea of justice itself. And when faith in these things is lost, all that is left is cynicism. That's a breach of trust that's not easily repaired. And so we owe it to our fellow citizens and to our cause not to let that happen. Second, always remember that you serve a cause far greater than yourself. Pride comes before a fall. So be humble. I know that's an unusual admonition from a politician. We are not generally known for our excessive humility. But history is littered with examples of worthy causes that failed because of infighting, because of petty grievances and selfishness. So ignore the petty politics. Don't bicker agency to agency, office to office, official to official. Instead, if we are to succeed in turning the Leviathan, we can't succumb to those impulses. We must work together to accomplish the job. Third, the Constitution must be our lodestar. Restoring the rule of law must begin with restoring the Constitution. And to do that, we must be fearless advocates of the proposition, best expressed by Justice Joseph Story, that the Constitution has a fixed meaning and is not dependent on the passions or parties of particular times, but the same yesterday, today, and forever. No Constitution is worth the paper it is written on if it can be ignored or revised on a whim by judicial or executive fiat. Just ask the Soviet Union and so many totalitarian regimes we have seen throughout history. We must rebuild our legal culture so that both the legal profession and the people re-embrace the principle implicit in a written constitution that the law is not something to be shaped as a potter molds clay. Rather, it is to be dispassionately applied. The judge's task is to apply the law, not to invent it. Fourth, we should continue focusing on law students and young people, just like Justice Scalia did. As I described in my remarks in the Congressional Record, Justice Scalia understood that changing the languishing legal culture would take drastic measures. So he wrote his dissents with a specific target in mind: law students. His aim was to delight their senses and engage their brains. To this end, he liberally employed colorful metaphors, pithy phrases, and biting logic. And he mercilessly, yet playfully, exposed the abundant flaws in the writing and reasoning of other justices. Pure applesauce. Jiggery pokery. Argle bargle. If you squinted hard enough, you could almost convince yourself that G.K. Chesterton had taken up a seat on the Supreme Court. This election may help save the day for now. But to prevail in the long run, we must capture the hearts and minds of young people and impress on them the same fidelity to law, the same devotion to liberty that built our nation. And finally, in the battles sure to come over the rule of law in our nation, there will be bitter disappointments and setbacks. That is inevitable in any worthwhile and difficult endeavor. I was told that yesterday at this conference, Justice Alito gave very good advice. When those times come, we should always ask ourselves, what would Scalia do? Perhaps we should even get wristbands made. After all, Justice Scalia was always the epitome of the happy warrior. Always hopeful, always good-natured, even when the Republic was hanging in the balance. His joy for life was evident to all. And every one of us could do very, very well to find inspiration in his worthy example. And above all, we must keep up the fight and never, ever, ever give in. Our nation, our people, our Constitution is worthy of our utmost devotion. Thank you.
Going to do that?
And now I'm happy to answer or dodge any question you like.
Thank you very much, Rory Broomfield from the Freedom Association in the United Kingdom. Again, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for their wonderful hosting of this wonderful convention. And to you, Senator Cruz, for your comments during the referendum campaign. Indeed, you mentioned referendums. We had one earlier this year to leave the European Union, a historic vote. And I wondered what your thoughts were now that we have a new you will have a new president come the new year. And we have a new Prime Minister, about the special relationship between our two great nations.
Well, I think the special relationship is vital. And I think a sad aspect of the last 8 years is how poorly it has been treated. Starting at the outset of the Obama administration with returning the bust of Winston Churchill, it is my hope that the Churchill bust will return to the White House. And the Brexit vote was historic. It was more than a little curious that President Obama, before that vote, thought it was somehow helpful to cross the Atlantic and condescendingly lecture the Brits that they should not dare exercise their own sovereignty. Perhaps the most puzzling thing is why he thought that would somehow be helpful in moving the vote in the direction he wanted it to go. Look, I think Brexit poses a tremendous opportunity to strengthen the free trade relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. Unlike what Obama said about getting to the back of the queue, I believe we should strengthen it and demonstrate what actual free trade means, not a back door for a multinational regulator trying to impose stifling regulations on everything, but rather an agreement that lowers tariffs, that opens trade and commerce and benefits to friends and allies. And I think that poses a remarkable opportunity, and I hope also provides real and meaningful economic competition for Europe to improve all involved.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, sir. My name is Philip Fender. I am from Tallahassee via Jamaica. and I don't have a question for you. What I want to say is thank you. Thank you for everything you've done. As a fellow immigrant, I want to let you know how much we appreciate you and how many people in Jamaica, as you know, Panton, really appreciate you. So thank you so much, sir, for being here. Thank you for being a part, and thank you for leading us in the right direction. We appreciate you.
Thank you very much for those kind and generous comments. Yes, sir.
First of all, again, Senator, thank you very much for your wonderful speech, and thank you for being with us. Like Rory earlier, I'm also from, I'm representing the Disraeli Society at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. But I'm from the Republic of Ireland, as the accent probably gives away. One thing I just have a question for you, in that I was raised in the countryside. I know what it's like to be told that you're stupid because of how you speak, to be think that you're forgotten by, you know, government, by your parliament, when it's just not... Well, they say it's not affordable to, you know, bring these services out to where you live. You don't really matter. So with the presidential election, where we saw that rural America, an America that felt they were left behind, stood up and expressed their voice and showed their concerns in such a large number, what words of encouragement do you now have for the people of rural America and for those who felt they were left behind going forward now that they have spoken with their voice?
Well, I think the election was an incredible vindication for the American people across this country, and especially those, as you note, in rural America, in what elites on both coasts consider to be flyover country. This election could be well understood as the revenge of flyover country. And one of the things that was most striking was the utter astonishment of the Hillary Clinton campaign, of the press, of Democrats. I'm reminded of, in an earlier election, a question from Manhattan: how could Richard Nixon have won? I don't know anyone who voted for him. I think the Clinton campaign found themselves utterly flabbergasted. They had not even contemplated the possibility that they might not prevail. And that, I think, is a direct result of not listening to and not hearing the American people, the voices of frustration, the voices that have been ignored, the voices that were crying out, more than anything else, leave us alone. Those voices haven't been heard in Washington by Democrats and far too often by Republicans either. And I think this election poses an opportunity for us to listen to the voices of the American people, to hear them and to come together and actually solve the real problems in this country. When you're given control of the executive and the legislature, it's time to put up or shut up. There are no excuses. We've got to deliver, and I think that is what the voters across the country expect, and it's what I very much hope we will give them.
Thank you, Senator, and from across the ocean in Europe, we're wishing you all the best of luck.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hey, Mike Doherty here from Atlanta. In 30 seconds, could you just solve the problem of the combo of the Administrative Procedures Act and Chevron deference that's been going on for the past century? Now that we finally have read across the board, how do we start that? Since I think most of the public knows something's wrong,
yes,
but they don't know what it is. There's no face to it. So now we can finally start, I think. How would you suggest we start?
Listen, that is a fabulous question. And one of the things that the men and women here understand is that the growth of Leviathan has no greater manifestation, no more pernicious manifestation than the regulatory state, than the army of unelected bureaucrats who often believe they answer to no political authority higher than themselves. They do not answer to the people. And we see these regulations growing and growing and growing and stifling freedom, stifling job creation, stifling wages. We've got an opportunity to fix that. And indeed, I would turn that argument back on you a little bit, and I would encourage everyone here to use your training to think about how we ratchet back this regulatory state. I can tell you a couple of days ago, I brought my entire Senate office together, from the chief of staff down to the most junior intern. And I said, I want all of us to start thinking very, very hard, start thinking very, very creatively, to pull out a notepad and brainstorm what can and should be done to reduce the burdens of Washington on small businesses and job creators using every axis. What can and should be done with executive authority? The one silver lining of Obama's abuse of executive power is everything done through executive power can be undone through executive power. I have spent some time visiting with the president-elect, with the transition team, and very much encouraging that team to use executive authority not only to turn back the abuses of the Obama era, but also to use it in legitimate ways to reduce the burdens of government. And when it comes to the regulatory state, the APA and Chevron, you know, what Obama has done wrong with executive power is he's intruded into the Article I legislative authority of Congress. Under Article I, it is Congress that makes the law, and the president cannot change the law or ignore the law. But under Article II, the president has robust executive authority. The executive authority is vested in one president of the United States, and the entire regulatory state represents Congress over the decades trying to tie the hands of the president of the executive. It is my hope this administration takes on vigorous regulatory reform, taking on, not as has been the past, just a one-way ratchet. We've seen in the past where Democrats in power regulate like crazy, and Republicans in power continue regulating just a little bit more slowly. Yeah, I had a friend of mine suggest a bumper sticker: Republicans, we waste less. I very much hope that at the end of this administration, we won't be saying that. Instead, we will say that we use this mandate from the people to take on the regulatory state, to rescind regulations, to fire regulators who are abusing their power, to retake liberty. All right, last question.
Thank you, Senator. My name is John Vorparian. I'm from New York, the Tony suburbs of Westchester County.
Wonderful.
I do have a thought, and during the course of the campaign, particularly the primary, I did imagine you in another capacity, and I'm just wondering.
So did I.
I'm wondering now if perhaps that ninth seat, any possibility?
Well, thank you for the kind encouragement. What I will say is that history is long and can take unexpected paths. I think it is absolutely vital that that seat and every other seat that comes vacant on the court be filled by principled constitutionalists who will be faithful to the law and will check their own policy preferences at the door and simply honor their oath. I can also tell you that I have right now the privilege of serving in the United States Senate, of representing 27 million Texans. That is a privilege and a responsibility I take very, very seriously. And I look forward to continuing to carry out that responsibility and continuing to fight for the principles of freedom and the principles embodied in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. They are very much in jeopardy right now, and I, like I suspect many of you, am very excited by the historic opportunity we have been given right now, and I look forward to working very hard to make the most of this opportunity to make the biggest difference for our country. Thank you.
Senator Cruz. Thank you so much for being with us today, Senator Cruz. We certainly appreciate it.